Hey everybody, it's Brian. Listen, I was a huge NBA fan in the 90s, early 2000s, and this guy I met at the Epic Risk Management Symposium. Epic is a sponsor of this show, and they put on a symposium. I've mentioned it a few times where I was happy enough to talk about my addiction in front of an audience, and so did this gentleman. Randy Livingston played in the NBA for a great many years. He was the top high school player and also a great advocate of gambling addiction. So please listen to this. You can hear the joy in my voice just hearing his NBA stories. And he was really great at talking about his addiction and sharing it. Check out the article written about him in The Undefeated. I'll try to link it in the show notes. And also check out his website, also linked in the show notes. Just a pleasure to have Randy Livingston on this episode of the podcast. Hello and welcome to All In the Addicted Gamblers podcast. My name is Brian and I have not placed a bet since July of 2014. And with me today is NBA player and current coach, Randy Livingston. Randy has a gambling addiction and he's here to talk about it with us. Randy, thank you so much for doing this.
Oh, thanks, Brian, for having me. It's a pleasure to be on the podcast.
You know, and I left out advocate. You are also an advocate now and you're doing advocacy work and that's really commendable. Thank you for the work you're doing because you have a big voice.
Yeah, I think, you know, sometimes, as we know, we have hundreds of thousands of million people out there that are suffering with this disease. And, you know, I think it's not hard to, it's not easy to come out and talk about it or just ask for help. And I think at the end of the day, if my voice leads to more and more people getting help, I feel really, really good about that. And hopefully I can use this platform and other platforms to just help people, you know, realize that they're not alone. We all, you know, battle this evil monster and, you know, it takes time day to day. And it takes the ability to admit that you have a problem. And then that's the only way you can start to really heal and get help.
When you decided to come out, I mean, you did the big article in The Undefeated about your addiction. When you decided to tell people about it, were you aware of anybody else in your world or people you knew of with a gambling addiction?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of family members, they don't admit it, but their family members, there's people that I played with in the NBA, people that I coached in the NBA Development League. There's lots of people, whether they want to admit it or not, in the circle of sports that have problems. But this addiction attacks everybody. It doesn't matter if you're in sports, doesn't matter if you have a lot of money, medium money, little money. You know, once you're addicted, you know, it's pretty hard to shake. So people all around me struggle with this addiction. So I knew of a lot of people.
So that nickname of the hidden addiction rings true in your world as well.
Oh, no question.
What made you decide to do that big write-up in The Undefeated and tell people about your gambling addiction? And then where are you today with your addiction?
Yeah, I am still sober. I haven't placed a bet at a casino or anywhere in the world of any sort of betting, whether it's playing, you know, the NCAA fantasy pool, doing the Final Four or doing NCAA tournament. I don't do anything. And it's been since April, I'll say March, I'm sorry, the end of March 2017 was the last day. So I'm still consider a fairly newbie, but I have, you know, stayed the course. It was a lot of hard work for someone like myself who was petrified of just sharing my story, worrying about what people thought, guilt, all of the people that I was still trying to get a job as a coach in the NBA and still in college to be a head coach. I just didn't want that side to be known. But, you know, it took a long time to come to grips that, you know, it kind of unleashed a heavy cloud that was hanging over me for a while once I decided. But it took a lot of work. It really did. Going to a 30-day program that lovely here in the state of Louisiana that allows residents to go to free core. That really changed me. And I fought it for a long time, but spending 30 days away from my family, probably the first 10, 15 days at that place, I fought it. And then finally, you know, I realized that I must get something out of it. And then after I left, I still was struggling with that guilt factor. Like, what am I going to do next? I didn't have a job. I had started to recover, not knowing, you know, was a hard thing. But then I worked the program. I went to that inpatient, then I went to an outpatient program when I got out. And that was, you know, that changed my life forever. And I'm forever grateful for that. I've done GA, you know, I've done the 12 steps. And, you know, I think for me, it was just time, man. I think I had struggled with it for so long and it was just so under wraps. I'm sure people know, maybe they didn't know, but it was just time for me to get it out to the world to kind of move on with life. I think I didn't have too many more relapses left for me. I didn't have too many more gambling binges where, you know, every year, whatever you work for, then you lose it all and you work. And I just didn't have, I didn't have any more in me. And it was time.
Had you previously tried to stop?
Yeah, many times. I self-excluded. And I think that was kind of the beginning of the end. I self-excluded. The state police, I won a lot of money. They took it. And then I could have went to jail, but I got a citation. And then 2-3 weeks later, I think I knew we were about to get fired as a staff at LSU. And I went back. And the craziest thing, I saw the same cop.
Oh,
and he was like, I can't believe you're back in here again. And from that point on, I walked out. He gave me another ticket. And then I looked at a board, you know, the 1-800, you need help, if you need help. And I called and I went home and told my wife, which I had opened up to her about everything. And she knew already. And she said, basically, I was like, do you want me to do the outpatient? And she's like, no, you're doing the inpatient. You're going to the treatment center. And off, I was there the next day. Or maybe that afternoon I was there.
Really?
Well, yeah.
So we've talked a lot on this podcast about the inpatient facility. Well, I shouldn't say a lot. They get mentioned from time to time. They're famous because there's only three gambling specific ones in the States. You're in Louisiana, so you were one of the fortunate people who got to attend for free. Like you said, what is sort of the day to day without divulging anything personal? What is the day to day in there like for somebody who doesn't know, who's thinking about doing an inpatient program?
Yeah, I think it's tough for me. Having my freedom and being able to do whatever I wanted to do when I wanted to do, it was tough. They take your phone, you know, you get it on Sunday, or you get it maybe an hour a day, but then you have to share it with everybody in there. So you only have 5-10 minutes telephone time. I think I remember going in there. It was the finals, Cleveland and Golden State, when they were going at a time. So I always would watch, but I couldn't watch that. And then you're around people that you don't know, but then you have something in common. So that was kind of the weird thing. That was the miracle of the house. Nobody knew each other in there, but we all shared this one common bond. And, you know, I think they do a lot of programming. You see pretty much during normal work hours, you see twice, you do two sessions with counselors and they're your individual counselor. And then you go to all these GA meetings and then you go to AA meetings, which I hated. I was like, shit, I'm not an alcoholic. Why the hell am I doing AA meetings?
Right.
And you fight it, right? You do all of the things that you're in denial, right? And I'm sure I was the biggest a-hole to probably a couple of the counselors because I didn't really believe in it. I was like, I'm strong enough. I've conquered. I had a knee injury. I played in the NBA. A lot of people say on one leg. So I'm, you know, big bravo. And then you have me who played in the NBA and then you had normal people. Right. So then the ego, you know, thing was just kicking in. And then, but after a while you meet some new people, some neat people. And like I said, we all had that common bond, right? Gambling. So I think once you hear somebody's story, you can start to relate to it. I'm not the only one. And no story is worse than yours or bad, you know? So I think at the end of the day, it served its purpose. The 30 days was really, really, really hard for me because as a man, you're protector of your family and you weren't there for your family. And that was a struggle. But, you know, we played sports. We played fun games. You know, we played a lot of them. I got cornhole, you know, became a cornhole player. You know, you do stuff outdoor, you do the ultimate frisbee outside and the golf, whatever. Like they did a lot of things to keep you occupied, but you know, it was still very tough not to communicate with the outside world.
A lot of sports gamblers that I know who no longer gamble might be hard for them to watch sports. Seems like a whole nother level for you. Sports is your life. I mean, it's not just you watch it on Sunday or whatever with football. It's you're in it. Is it hard for you to watch sports now? No, because you weren't really gambling on sports.
Yeah, I was never a sports gambler. I just went to the casino here and they had the land bases or whether you're in Vegas or where you're not. And I just played craps and, blackjack goes with my games of choice. And never bet on sports. That was never my deal. I don't know how, you know, I kind of, you know, you think of a gambler, you can separate the two, but for some reason I did. But, you know, and it was from little. I mean, I tell my story in the podcast, and I've had many conversations with my mom and family. They just played cards when we were little. We figured out that was the way to earn a couple extra dollars to make it work. And you think a person that plays in the NBA, you don't really need to earn any extra money, but that's all I saw when I was growing up. And, you know, my mom is, for me, the greatest mother in the world. And I don't think at the time, you know, she was thinking she was modeling any type of behavior, because as you get older, it's your choice. You make choices, but like you saw it at a very early age. And, but for sports, to get back to your question, I love sports. So I was a football player at heart when I was younger. Still, that's my first love, and basketball, I just got better at it. Well, but I like watching the game. It's weird watching a game of basketball gives you that same high of gambling, because I can kind of predict the outcome. I've played with some of these guys. I know what's happening. You know, it's kind of, it's a already weird feeling, but it did do that for me. But I enjoy the, because I coach now and I always play a cerebral game. I enjoy that game of chess of seeing how people make adjustments during a 7-game series. That's the fun in it for me. So it's not hard. I enjoy the competitiveness, and it's the same competitiveness you get with gambling, but I was always able to separate the two, but I enjoy just watching sports. I do. And I watch it. I got a team of kids that I'm trying to prepare to get better, always looking for the new nuances of the game. So I have no problem watching sports.
As you said about your mother being the world's greatest mother, I will go toe to toe against you with that, in my mother as well. But my parents also gambled. We played cards and for money when I was a kid, in the same way that you said, you know, you don't blame her. I don't blame my parents at all for this. It was just, I mean, that's what we did. I played cards with my grandparents, my parents. It's what we did. And that's how you kind of, it seemed normal. It seemed like what you do. But I got to ask, because I read it in that Undefeated article, what is Pity Pat?
Pity Pat is you get, everybody around gets 5 cards, and then you flip over a card, and then you just, the first person to get 3 pairs win.
Okay.
So it's a quick game. So you can always, like, quickly, just in an hour time, win a lot of money, or 30 minutes time, win a lot of money. It depends on how the cards are running that day. But it was probably that and playing dice in the neighborhood I grew up with, popular. That's what we did. And then, you know, between Pity Pat and a game called Tunk, that was a game of choice of NBA players, and Bure. Those are like high stakes, you know, more money. So, you know, just, you graduate. Like, I graduated from playing Pity Pat and all that stuff. And then when I got to high school, there was more money involved. And then I learned poker, but never really, I didn't love it, but I think I had beginner's luck at that in the beginning. But then I always just was a craps guy and a blackjack guy.
Yeah. So we met at the Epic Symposium, where we were both on separate panels, and I really enjoyed what you had to say there. But we stayed at this hotel, and I got to tell you the story about the hotel. I used to work in hotels, and I was a night auditor, so I would talk to the night auditor whenever I see him. And I got back, I don't know, the first or second night, and the night auditor working, you know, I said, oh, I used to do this, blah, blah, blah. Now I'm here doing this. He said, oh, what are you here for? I said, oh, gambling addiction. He said, gambling addiction. He said, I play dice games. And he was telling me about this. And this is just some random guy at the hotel working. And he happened to also talk about how much he got in trouble with his partner for playing dice and for gambling. And I was like, this is just some random dude. And he also has this gambling thing on him. So it was amazing that it just shows up.
It's all over. It's everywhere.
It's just crazy. When did you first notice that it was causing harm for yourself?
I think once I got to college, and the college athletes get their Pell Grant, and then we would gamble all night till you broke the room, whether you're playing cards or craps. And so that was probably the first step. And then the other one, when you know you had a problem, when you betray all your values, like, and the most important value is like the risk going to jail. You know, you were underage at the casino and you decided to go anyway. when you're 18, you're supposed to be 21 and you go, and me being the number one player in the country, my junior and senior year in high school, and everybody in Louisiana and the national knew me. I mean, I still thought I could get away with it. I think that kind of like was the beginning to the end.
Oh, so you were getting away with something. They weren't just letting you in because of who you were?
No, I just went in and I blended in, but I looked older. Like, yeah, they didn't check ID. If they didn't check ID, they don't know. But I'm sure someone on the boat, but everybody thought I was older than I was, but maybe not. Freshman year in college, I don't know. There are not too many freshmen that are 21 years old, but sometimes there are.
Did your knee injury impact your gambling?
I think so. Idle time. I think there was a lot of idle time. And so then I didn't really, basketball was my life, right? So I didn't really know what to do with that idle time.
Did it cause, I mean, did your knee injury cause you depression too that made you gamble? Did you ever gamble because you were depressed?
I probably think so. I think I probably gambled more, not, I won't say out of depression, but you know, that fantasy world, right? You think, okay, whatever, I not got hurt, I would have been making gazillions. So let me make up for it. Let me try to get that. I think that was, I think, some of the thinking. I think overall in college, I was depressed and I didn't know how to get help, because I went from a utopia world where I never had any injuries and the best player, I consider best player in the world for ages 12 all the way to I was 17, 18 years old. And it didn't matter who was out there. I thought I was the best. And then when I got hurt, it just went downhill. You just didn't know what would happen. You know, I never had an injury before, like not even an ankle sprain or a pinky sprain, anything. And so, yeah, I think I definitely was depressed at that time. And I think it led to me just seeking other stuff. And that other stuff was a vice that, you know, you just don't know.
Did you ever have other vices? Drugs? You said no alcohol.
No drugs. I mean, if you're in New Orleans, you drink a little bit, but I didn't drink more than any other college student. Gambling just, it got a hold of me to where, you know, it affected my marriages, my relationship with my kids, my relationship with people that I really are like brothers to me. Like, I grew up with the Mannings. I grew up with Dr. Andrews, who's like this famous surgeon, and his son was good. He does surgery.
He does all the Tommy John surgery, right?
Yeah, he did my knee surgery. He done Bo Jackson hip. Like, those are relationships that I had that, you know, I just think the world of basketball. Like, I should be an NBA head coach right now. I know now the gambling stuff that I don't know. Some teams make decisions you never know. But I feel like I know I could be an NBA head coach easy and be very good at it. And, you know, and maybe those things are still in the cards. I don't know. Maybe gambling affected it. I'm not sure. But it's just one of those things.
What is it like for you to have achieved your dream? I assume your dream was going to the NBA since you were so good at basketball so young. I assume the NBA was the ultimate dream. What's that like for somebody to do that?
Well, it was extra special for me because I defied the odds a few times. Growing up in the neighborhood I grew up with, I wasn't supposed to play college basketball, college degree, or play in the NBA. The two friends, my best friends, are both dead that I grew up with. So, you know, that was a thing. And then after achieving everything I achieved and looked like a surefire NBA first round lottery Hall of Fame type player, to have two major knee injuries and still get drafted by the Houston Rockets was a lot of perseverance, a lot of hard work, a lot of dedication that, again, defied the odds. So to get drafted in the 1996 draft by the Houston Rockets, after all that I had been through, it was a special night, not only for me, for my family. And I think the day I decided to leave college, there was the rule they had just put in where you can put your name in a draft but not hire an agent and go back to school if you wanted to. And once I decided I was gone, I knew I wasn't coming back. And I knew when I made the decision, I said I would do whatever it take to play as long as I could play, not knowing that I would be an NBA journeyman and play on, you know, 10, 11 teams and have the most call-ups by a minor league player in the history of NBA. I just dedicated. And I think a lot of that, we can have that war about best moms, but like my mom worked from 6 o'clock to 11 o'clock every night. So I saw that drive and determination from all my teenage years, from ages 10 to I finished high school. And, for her to do that, I was just playing a game, right? All I had to do is just get healthy. And that led me to just, continue to get up when I was tired, when people thought my career was over with, to continue to move forward. And so that I knew once I decided to leave that everything in my fiber of my body, I would make it. Now, I don't know what my career earnings was, but I don't know if I, now looking back, when I did a financial, I think affidavit or whatever you do when you go to treatment, I always told myself, man, I know there was one summer I didn't gamble, 1 year I didn't gamble. And then I was just lying to myself, out of my whole career, every year I gambled. Season was over with, not doing the season, maybe gambled minimal or gambled, but then as soon as the season was over with, that idle time, boom, I was just back into it. Trying to get more money, I guess, from lost time or made up of money that I thought, again, that fantasy world, right?
Yeah.
That's how my career was. It was a, you would think, out of the hard work to finally make it and go through the minor leagues and then make it. I don't know. I just was in a system. I worked hard, made it. And then I say, okay, let me reward myself. Let me go gamble in the summers for 3 months. I would train still, but then after training, I would train twice a day. And from maybe 10 o'clock till 2-3 in the morning, I would go gamble at the boats every year of my whole 11-year career.
You weren't gambling on the boat, so during the season, just gambling with other players, locker rooms?
Yeah, just with other players. If we were on the planes or, if we went to a city that had gambling, I'm sure I would find it. There was no team in Las Vegas, but Summer League was there. So I made my way to Vegas, or when I was back home, wherever there was a casino boat, I made it. Or land casino, I found a way to get there.
You got drafted by the Rockets, the year after the championship? Back-to-back, right?
Yeah, after back-to-back. And they traded for Charles Barkley. So they had a lot of Sam Cassell they traded, Robert Horry, Kenny Smith, and they had a use for guards. And so, yeah, I went there. And, man, that was the highlight of my life, man. I won't lie. My basketball career, after all that I've been through, I got placed to play with three of the top 50 players of all time. Hakeem Olajuwon, Clyde Drexler, and Charles Barkley. And then some incredible veterans, Mario Elie, Kevin Willis, Eddie Johnson, Saddle Three. Nah, it was amazing. It was real fairy tale-ish. It was like, okay, come on. And the thing is, I knew I was close when I left because I had dedicated a lot of time to rehabbing. I left training camp as the starting point guard for the Rockets with those three Hall of Fame guys. And the first game was in New Orleans, Louisiana, against one of my childhood idols in Avery Johnson. He's from New Orleans. And when I hurt myself, he probably one of the few players, he wrote on a hotel card a note to me that made it to me after I got hurt. So I'm going into that game as the starter. And the day before we leave to come to New Orleans, I pulled my hamstring, I believe. And then that's how Matt Maloney got to play on that team and got to start.
Really?
Yeah, and that's how I came out of training camp. I beat him out, Brent Price out, Emmanuel Davis. I beat out everybody because I had a gift of making it easier for the older guys. So they had a young point guard that could pass the ball and make it easier for them. They loved that. And yeah, and then I got hurt. But Rudy, I was at the press conference because it was in New Orleans, not Charles, not Hakeem, not Clyde. It was me. It was going home. And Rudy was like, Randy, I'm going to let you play this game, but after that, we're going to shut you down for the regular season because you're out diamond in the rough. And then that's how Matt Maloney came along and got the job, and he never relinquished it. He fit just as well. So it was an interesting thing, but differently though, because he could shoot the basketball. And so you had to double Charles or Hakeem and Clyde, and he just sat out there and shot three-pointers. Where I was different, I created for them.
Well, I mean, those are the years, I pay attention to the NBA now, but the years that you're talking about is when I loved the NBA, when I was playing NBA Live 95 and all that. Gotcha. And, those are the years that I loved, and that you named players. And I think you said Mario Elie, and I'm like, he was number 17, right? Like, that's what sticks in my head, is because those are the years that I watched. And out of everybody you said,
Matt, we would have beat the Bulls.
Well, okay. Since you brought it up, You did that article with the Undefeated with Mark J. Spears, and you said you got to trust the writer. But he, there's this picture in here, and the caption on this picture doesn't say Randy Livingston guarding Michael Jordan. It says Randy Livingston of the Houston Rockets tries to guard Michael Jordan. How did you let him stick that tries in there?
Everybody tried to guard Mike. Everybody. It was the best, man. It's not, and I'm a huge LeBron fan, but I think he's just different. He's a different animal. I mean, I just, when you went into that Chicago arena and that music came on, yeah, you know, the Black Cat, that's what we call him. He was coming out. He was going to be in for a long day. But our team was built to beat them, though, because Mario was tough. Clyde was good. Nobody could stop Jordan, but Clyde did a good job on Pippen. But Dennis, he was guarding Charles or Akeem, and he wasn't good enough to guard Akeem. But whoever was guarding, Luke Longley couldn't guard Charles, or Luke Longley couldn't guard Akeem. So we beat them that year. All you got to do is go back. We beat them in the United Center and in Houston. One time Ramadan, I think Akeem Olajuwon had a ridiculous like 37 points, 17 rebounds, 12 blocks, and like 8 assists, like with no water, no food. Like, it was crazy. We that team was built to beat them, but we couldn't get through Utah. It was a weird, weird deal there. But that was a great year. That and playing in Phoenix and Seattle, those were probably highlights of my NBA career, because I got to start in the playoffs with the Suns after all of that stuff. And we beat the Spurs, who were champions. They had beat the Knicks before in the lockout year. And the next year, we knocked them out in the first round.
That was Robinson's last year and Duncan's first year, right? Didn't they win together?
Something like that. Yeah. Lockout. And then we lost to the Lakers. Shaq and Kobe was unbeatable. That was.
Until my Pistons went and took them down.
They did. They had an old core after that, though. But no, the Pistons were a great team.
Yeah, that 2004.
One quick Larry Brown story.
Yeah, I'll take all the stories you have, but I know you don't have time.
Everybody knew I was going to go to North Carolina coming out of high school. That was my dream school. My mom's house, my wall is still Carolina blue. There's still some Carolina stuff in there. So I wound up going to LSU, but we played in Detroit that year. They were super good. I think I was playing for the Clippers. I'm warming up, and Larry Brown says, "Randy, look at the bench. Had you gone to North Carolina, you would have had this." And the bench was like Phil Ford, Pat, I can't think of Pat's last name, but it was all North Carolina bench. And it was like, once you're part of the family, you would have always been part of the family. And he rubbed it in so bad. He said, "You know, you should have went there." And all I could do was laugh. That's all. And she was, because me and Rasheed were good friends and still are to this day. All I could do is laugh, because they were all standing next to each other. It was like six North Carolina guys in a row. Crazy.
Well, I think I told you this when I saw you, but I lived in Durham for a while. So right there with North Carolina and Duke on either side. And I think Rasheed started coaching high school when I was living down there, down in that region, like you are now. How do you think, you know, being the best player that you were from 12 to 17 in the country, now you're coaching kids who are that or some level of that. How did your experience, whether frustrating or not, how has that led to you being a better coach for them?
No, it's amazing. It's not even frustrated. I think sometimes, you know, life happens, right? And I think you get your calling. That's why, like, I think I'm an NBA head coach. So they're getting NBA head coaching at a high school level. And really my experience, everything that I've gone through, from the highs of the highs, the lows of lows, from being a top player in the world, to being a bench player, a journeyman in the NBA, being the top player in the G League, winning the MVP, the oldest MVP at 31, 32 in the G League, which is weird. But like, I think all those experiences helped me to help these kids not only become better players, but better human beings. And then on top of that, the gambling stuff, right? I think it just makes it to this where you're meant to be, right? You're meant to be to help these young men on a path that maybe they become pros or not, but maybe they just become better human beings. Maybe they understand what teamwork, what dedication, what, you know, and the most important thing to me that I think I get out of this, and my brother told me this, is like, the first time when I took this job, he was like, it's not about the retired jersey on the wall. It's about these kids. And if I can just help one of them avoid any type of pitfalls, mistakes, and I'll say this for that. The most important thing is don't be afraid to get help, no matter what you're going on in life. It doesn't matter if it's school. It doesn't matter if you have an alcohol addiction, or now the online social media addiction, the gaming addiction, gambling addiction, no matter what type of issues you're dealing with, don't be afraid to get help. And I think that's probably more valuable of lesson I can give back, more, even more than the X and O's is in working out and helping them choose colleges and doing all that stuff. It's that part of it, getting help. Don't be too big to get help.
Thank you for saying that. That's like truer words have never been spoken. That's the hard part, is reaching out.
Oh, big time. Because we all have egos. We all think we're strong and prideful, and you know, and that can be a detriment. And we know that. Had you told me I left high school and would then traveled the world, had a gambling addiction, overcome it, coached professionally, coached college, lived in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, lived in Boise, lived in Australia, played in Europe, went to Saskatchewan, played in the coldest place in the world to me. I mean, I would have never thought it, but to be back here today and to be able to help young men, life become a little bit easier because of my experiences, I wouldn't trade that for the world.
Man, your outlook is so good. I sat there putting words in your mouth saying frustrated about the knee injury, and you're like, no, it's all gravy. Like, everything is great. I got to where I got. It's good.
Yeah, I made it. Like, my brother always tell me, he's like, why do you need to just retire or quit after you made it to the NBA? You did something that nobody did from the projects from New Orleans. You had already made it. You kept going because you wanted to, you had to feed your hunger to go gamble. So you kept making some money to go gamble. So, but he was like, you made it. Like, not too many people make it to the NBA, and you made it out of all the odds. You still made it. And so, yeah, I enjoyed every bit of that ride, but life is so much better now not gambling. I won't lie to you. Like, I tell people all the time, like, I don't have to cover lie after lie. I don't have to worry about where my next meal is coming from. I have, you know, money in the bank. Yeah. I'm blessing. I have good kids. Still trying to make amends for some relationship with my older kids. You know, those are day by day things that come with the life of a gambler, right? We can't go back, we can't change it, but like those things come with it and you got to work through it. There's not a day that goes by that I know I messed up some relationships, and one by one, I try to make amends. I know I can't do it all at one time, but eventually I try to make amends to all of it and move on and live a great life now, which I totally do. And I got a book that I'm almost finished. And then we're going to start a biopic here in another week, start shooting. So with the same people, if you get a chance, they did a primetime live piece on me. And when I was in high school, Diane Sawyer, well, the director and the producer of that, we're still friends today. We met in New York when I came, and she's like,
oh, cool.
There's no greater thing than to do this biopic and restart and kind of go full cycle. So there's a lot of incredible things going on right now, and we'll win a state championship this year, probably after 30 years, you know, at this school. So I'm blessed, man. I went through a lot. It was hard. It definitely was hard, but I'm in a better place now because I think I finally had came out, right? I told the world after all those years holding on to that stuff, I came out and things couldn't be better. And the same thing that I used to be like, feel guilty about or have the stigma of being a gambler, I used to worry about that all the time. It's now like this blessing. It's amazing how, like, once you share with the world, because there's like a human side to it, right? A lot of people have these stories that it's all great and whatever, but there's a human side to it where not so much you triumph something, it's just that we struggle and you struggle and you learn and you get help and you get better. And like now I'm able to talk about it. 4 or 5 years ago, I would never have been able to talk about this. I was so petrified of how people would think and feel, to now I've opened it up in the book. I talk about it all the time. I go talk about it to people that are strangers. Like, that's the, like, the most craziest thing. And I was so scared to come back. And that's what life's about, to this, where I'm at Newman High School, because all these people looked up to me. I was a godsend. I was like this perfect angel. So I was like, I want to keep that image, but that's not what life's about. And like, for me, able to come back here, even on my interview to get the job, I told them, look, I'm in recovery and this is where I was. I'm not there anymore. For no job interview I did for an MBA, I talked about that. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's crazy, but like, they accepted me. This is home. I know this is where I'm supposed to be. That's how amazing this is.
After the article came out, did you have other players who you played with or anybody like that? You don't have to give me names, but just, did anybody reach out to you to say like, oh man, I had no idea that this was causing you this much harm or this was that addiction?
No, not too many people. People were generally happy that, you know, I'm in a better place now. Yeah. I know that because I have so many teammates. I know that was struggling. So what I'm hoping from all of this is, it opens that avenue and door to the NBA, which I think it is, to really, you know, this is such a taboo topic, but it's only going to get worse now. It's just inevitable that a scandal is going to happen. Let's be honest with all this stuff. It's just inevitable because there's no, and I hate to say that, but the thing is not if, but when, and then how do we deal with it? How do players deal with it? How do players that have serious gambling problems, is there help for them? So I would really like to start a core for athletes, just for athletes, because the beds were small. So I don't know if they're going to go to Shreveport, but like start a facility, you know, like they have the drug facility for all of these celebrities. Yeah. Have a place for sports figures to go, remain anonymous, and just get help. Like, that's my ultimate goal. Like, that's my bucket list that I would love to do. And hopefully I can work with the NBA, NFL, Major League Baseball, hockey, whatever, and go around and talk, tell my story and be able to share and hopefully let people know that there's help out there and that, you know, we can do this. We can conquer this with the right prevention. And that's why it's so important for the Epics of the world and all of these now sports betting and all these states that are, you know, legalizing gambling to take care of the citizens. Like, that's what the government's about. That's the responsibility that they have, right, to us. To make sure that, you know, they're making a lot of money, spending a lot of money, but ultimately people get hurt by this. We know this. We're two people, you know, we get hurt by this, and I think we can help. I think we can definitely, I think Epics, you know, they're way ahead of the curve. And guys like Keith White, and Brianna, I've worked with them. Like, we got to continue to push to get legislation to make sure people are looked after. Because it's coming, Chief. It's coming. And it's going to come. It's here now. It's so fast, how fast the sports betting and legalization of gambling has taken off. And whether it's a good or bad thing, that's not my, you know, say, but I know people need help. We know people are going to need help.
Well, Randy, I know you're a damn good basketball player, but I think you found your calling here talking about gambling addiction and just helping people because you're really good at it. So thank you so much for doing this.
No problem. And I know you asked me about the stuff that I talked about, the sports league. And yeah, and I, you know, I remember them quite, you know, canning a lot. One of them was like, this just me. We want to create a safe haven within the league offices and the players associating with each league, you know? And I thought some of the things I talked about was just having a person or someone designated as a home or gambling safe haven. So you can just call that person and say, hey, I have a problem. And then it doesn't get out. Because a lot of the shame, guilt is what goes on. And create a hotline and advertise it to the player. Because a lot of times, like me, I didn't know. Like, when I asked for help, they wanted to send me to John Lucas, who I've become friends with, and he was just alcohol and drugs. I didn't have that addiction. So I was like, that doesn't work for me. The hotline should be 24/7, because we know, me and you both know, gambling crisis can happen at any time, day or night. The safe haven can be accessed anonymously, which I think is important, and make the resources free and available, including residential rehab centers and outpatient programs. And I think this one is overlooked. I think the second point that I made when we talked about this, because I think it's a very overlooked one. We got to provide support for the families. because they're vital in this. If you're a wife of an NBA player, you're struggling. You have no idea, or NFL or Major League, but you have no idea how to really deal with this. So support for the family themselves and coping with the mental toll that it takes with living with somebody that has a gambling addiction. And then the tools and techniques to the family supporting the player. And I know there's Gammonon on the GA side of things, but it's nothing like for a professional family or sports to have those resources and how to identify the addiction and how to stage intervention. Because it's tricky. You love the person, but like, you're not trying to lose your relationship with them. You're trying to keep that money. All that stuff matters, but it's a skill to it. And then the last one is the destigmatization of gambling addiction. Like, I think this one is crucial, because for the first two points that I talked about to be successful, I think gambling addiction need to be destigmatized. Having people like myself and former players, people like yourself, talk to current players about gambling addiction. Make these talks part of the induction process of the young kids. I think it's a travesty that the first thing the NBA does with the rookies is bring them to Vegas. I mean, that's probably the worst place you want to put a kid. Not only gambling, you got prostitution, you got everything about the thing that an athlete should not do. They put them right smack in the middle of it. And it's for an 18-year-old kid, it's no way they're equipped to deal with that. And enlist support of other high-profile players and former players that speak and write about their experiences. I think that's important that more and more people begin to step out. Because you got the craziest thing over the pandemic, you watched The Last Dance, and I thought Mike had an incredible chance to really like help people, and he didn't. He just kind of like, they just touched on it and moved on. They didn't really, you know, it was weird how they did that, but he had a chance. But then, although he has all the money in the world, he can say, and everybody has to decide if they have a gambling problem right for themselves. But it was obvious you had some issues there, right? And discovers the glamorization of gambling by sports celebrities. You know, like I was friends with Charles Barkley still to this day. You know, there's a lot of stuff that goes on, but like now on everything that comes on TV, it doesn't matter if it's ESPN, TNT, there's the sports stuff betting on it. Like it's just right there. Yeah. And they just make it to where it's normal and like it's cool and it's good. And some people can gamble and not have a problem. I get that. But like, let's not glamorize it. Let's not make it like it's an incredible thing to do. And I think if we can do those things, I think, you know, like I said, the last part is important, especially if the other two things to work, creating a safe haven within the league offices and providing support for families. We got to destigmatize the gambling addiction. We got to figure out how to make that, you know, better. And I'm hoping, like you said, not too many people call me, but I'm hoping more people have read the Undefeated thing. And then the more I get out and talk, whether it's to colleges and going when the NBA do their meetings with all their players, whether it's the rookies, whether it's veterans, the more people talk about it, I think the more we can help. And they get educated about it. Those are things that are important to me.
You're definitely the man for the job, because that's a great list. And kudos to you for everything you're doing. I'm really thankful to have you as a part of this community now, because I not having met you until a month and a half, 2 months ago, whatever it was, so glad that we crossed paths so that we could have this conversation. So thank you very much for doing this.
No, I appreciate it. Anytime. Let me know and I can get on again, man. We're good. I enjoyed it.
Thank you, everybody, for listening.
This episode of the podcast is brought to you by Gamban. Gamban has all your blocking solutions for online gambling. In this day and age when gambling online is very prevalent, use Gamban to block it. The prices are very reasonable and they're good, good people.
This podcast is owned by Lee Street Media, LLC. Music provided by T. Vance. Remember, this is a podcast. The views expressed on the podcast are solely those of the hosts and the guests. If you need help for a gambling addiction, please seek professional help.